Blog Talk Radio.
Over 120 years ago, freedmen became lawmen. Independent communities were built. Businesses, schools, people were thriving. Until organized destruction ensued. Fires, murder, violence, poverty, disease, all seemed lost. A community of people barely alive. Fast forward the year 2012. We can rebuild. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first conglomerate of organized, united communities. The black community will be that force. Better than before. Better, stronger, united. Black Reconstruction with your co-hosts, Sister LaShawn Allen Muhammad and Brother Malik Green on Black Hole Radio.
Black Hole, Black Hole, Black Hole.
Okay, that was a really long intro. Are we live on the air, Sister Yvette?
Yes, ma'am, you are. Yes, ma'am,
okay.
You are. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. Okay. So, yes, I'm sorry, the theme music, I guess it wasn't finished. So, as I was saying, we have Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nimhard on the line. She's a professor, a political economist, and Associate Professor of Community Justice and Social Economic Development at John Jay College. She's also the Director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. She's also the immediate past president of the National Economic Association, fellow at the Center for the Study of Cooperatives at the University of Saskatchewan, that's in Canada, and also an affiliate with the Center on Race and Wealth in the Department of Economics at Howard University. So Dr. Nimhard has a lot of she's a wealth of information. She's just a wonderful educator, and I'm so excited to have her on the show tonight. She's done a great amount of studying on cooperatives, in particular in the Black community. And so she's joining us here tonight to talk about her work and how we can build upon that work. And those of you who have been following Black Reconstruction, just to remind you what the show is about, is looking at the blueprint, the independent communities that were developed post-slavery during the Reconstruction period, where the residents that lived in the towns also owned the businesses there. And a lot of the communities, because they had no other choice, they worked together, they worked cooperatively, and kept the economy or the community wealth within, you know, their own system. You know, so of course we all know what happened after Jim Crow and the black code, slave codes, and you know these efforts were ruined and destroyed on purpose. So now what we're looking at is, what does that blueprint look like, and how can we recreate these independent communities today? And one of the solutions or the mechanisms to get that done is working cooperatively. So, Dr. Nimhard, welcome. Welcome,
yes,
welcome, welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for that great introduction.
You are welcome. I mean, I'm sure I haven't done you justice. I mean, and the listeners will be able to hear exactly, you know, just like I said, you're just a wealth of information. I'm just so excited to finally have an opportunity to speak with you and to talk to you a little bit about, we only have an hour, but hopefully we can continue this conversation.
Sure.
And I just, yes. And I just also, when we communicated, you did remind me that today is the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And
yeah.
So I just wanted to acknowledge and thank you for bringing that to my attention, and just wanted to acknowledge that the anniversary, you know, of this horrible assassination, and just to honor him. And just acknowledge the amount of great work that he's done, you know, for the civil rights movement. And it was interesting when I was reading about what happened during the assassination, and the reason why he was in Memphis in the first place was to help advocate for the sanitation workers, you know,
right,
and
exactly.
Because the sanitation workers, you know, were not getting equal pay, you know, so they were working cooperatively, you know, to try to make a difference, you know. So it was just really interesting when I read about it. I said, oh, wow. You know,
yeah, it all comes back, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tonight we're going to talk about, you know, just the history of cooperative ownership in the African-American community. And, you know, that, and I think that this is actually really a topic that most people don't really know about. So I think it'll be really, really interesting, you know, for most people to even understand the what it is, number one, and then just to hear the history about it. So can you give us a brief overview of what that is?
I'd be happy to, though feel free to stop me, because I just finished, I don't know, I guess a 300 or 400-page book on this topic. So,
yes.
And I'll make a little plug for it, I guess, now, though I think you were
yes.
going to mention at the end. But I am next year, it should be coming out next year with Penn State University Press.
Mm-hmm.
The title of the book is Collective Courage, Collective Courage. And the subtitle is African American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice, A History of African American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. And so for the last probably 10 years now, maybe longer, my kids would say probably longer.
Mm.
I have been studying how African Americans have used cooperative economics in a variety of ways throughout their history in the U.S., from period of enslavement, but mostly from right after enslavement up to the present time. And I've been interested in the topic because, like as you have been and as your listeners, I guess, trying to figure out how to end poverty and inequality, particularly economic inequality, particularly in Black communities, but certainly for anybody. And I've been trying to figure out, how should I put this? So much of economics and economies that we use are so oppressive to certain groups of people, and I've been trying to figure out how we can use economics to liberate people and what kind of economies we can form that will be liberating. And so when I started to learn about cooperative business ownership, I realized that that's a real step toward that. And so actually one of the people I studied when I started to study about cooperatives was W.E.B. Du Bois, who most of you probably know as one of our great African-American statesmen and scholar and radical. What we don't know about him is that around the same time that he was writing his famous The Problem of the 20th Century is the Problem of the Color Line, he was also writing that the African-American community stands at a crossroads between trying to follow the same wrong ways to get... Oh, sorry, that's my dog. we're at the crossroads of trying to follow individualistic ways to get wealth or whether to go the collective route. And he said this in 1907, and that he was afraid we were going to make a mistake and try to follow the individualist route to wealth and not the collectivist route that would actually get us all much more wealthier and healthier. And so most people, as I said, you know, we all can say, talk about the color line statement, but nobody talks about his economic statement. And then he spent years studying, actually studying Black co-ops, talking about making speeches. And maybe there's something you could do quickly while I get my dog to quiet down.
Okay. He's interested in that. He wants to know, too. You know, it's very, you know, it's almost ironic, you know, in a way, because, you know, the he wrote a book called Black Reconstruction as well. W.B. Du Bois. And it was funny because when I was thinking about what to title this work, you know, I thought about Black Reconstruction just as a title, thinking about that time period and how it applied to Black people before I didn't even know he had written or I hadn't read about, you know, the book. So it was like,
Well, he was a prolific writer, so he wrote about almost anything all of us worry about or care about. You know, he's also one of the founders of the sociology discipline because of his pioneering work, particularly in urban sociology and studying African American peoples. The work that I looked at was actually in 1898 and in 1907. He wrote two books about Black business development, and they were both about cooperative economics, or what he called economic cooperation. So some of them weren't the formal co-ops that we call, you know, like a food co-op or whatever, but they were all about pooling of Black resources, pulling together money to either own a store or buy the needed equipment to do the farming or whatever. And so he actually documented thousands of mutual aid societies and cooperative businesses and collective ownership of housing or tractors or insurance companies and things like that. So it was a great find for me, even though it was work that most people haven't studied about him, to see that he was really pioneering.
Wow.
So I actually stepped from his work in 1907. I tried to figure out, well, what else has there been? So if we're saying that we should all do this collective economics, if we're saying we should pool our resources, work together, have we done it before, or is it something new we're asking African-American communities to do?
Right.
And so I actually realized that since Du Bois was the editor of the NAACP's Crisis magazine, I thought that I should start looking in the Crisis magazine to see if there were any descriptions or discussions about black co-ops.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, there were. So
wow.
I found like my first seven forms of evidence past what Du Bois had done in his 1907 book, I actually found in the pages of old Crisis magazines.
Amazing.
And there they actually had pictures of some of the early co-ops, talked about the study groups that were started, because another thing I found out as I got into this was that almost every business, cooperative business that was started, started with a study group,
mm-hmm.
where the potential members of the co-op all came together once a week and would study their economic condition, study the problem, but then study the solution and learn
right.
everything they could about co-op businesses and about business development and about democratic participation. And so that was another thing that was really important to find out, is not just that we did have a history and we do engage in collective economics, but also
mm-hmm.
that we were very deliberate about
yeah.
how we did it. And
yes,
very deliberate
blueprint.
About informing
mm-hmm.
ourselves and studying together and making sure we knew as much as we could before we even started a project.
Mm-hmm.
So almost every co-op that I actually found started in some way with some kind of study group, or somebody having gone to somebody else's study group, or somebody visiting another co-op. Sometimes they even went to Canada to study co-ops. So it's just turned out to be this rich history. I actually start my book saying it's a long but hidden history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a history that's always been there, but somehow it's not in our collective memories, or at least it's not what we pass on to each other.
Right, right.
I haven't quite figured out why not, except I think there's a lot of sort of anti-communist ideology, and some of the co-ops didn't always work, and so people have been reluctant, I think, to talk about them because they feel like it's more about failure.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I've now been talking all around the country about this, and everywhere I go, people come up to me and say, you know, first they say, oh, well, black people don't do co-ops, that's hippies or something. But then when I finish talking, they come back and tell me, oh, you know, my aunt and uncle were doing such and such, and my parents were part of such and such, and my grandparents. And suddenly they have their own family history of having been involved in some kind of cooperative economics.
Uh-huh.
So it's nice to be able to realize that when people understand more about what you're talking about, they can actually
yes.
then connect back to a memory or to a activity or to a program, you know, that their own family or their community was involved in.
Well, see, what I think might have happened with the break in history is integration. You know,
right.
I think that probably, you know, played a big part of, you know, how that got lost, you know, the practice of it and also the history, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think so. But I also think there's sort of the fear of doing something different, right? In school,
mm-hmm.
we're not taught about co-ops.
Right.
We're taught that you're supposed to go the individual way, and, you know, if you're going to do a business at all, you should start your own business, and if you're poor,
mm-hmm.
you shouldn't go into business at all because it's too risky, and
mm-hmm.
you don't know what you're doing, and you're not trained well, you know, and that only, you know, a select few get to be these chosen one, even though
mm-hmm.
we also have the, you know, the Horatio Alger myth that anybody can just start a business and become rich. So we have these mixed messages, but mostly it's about, you know, being afraid of trying to do something with other people and either trying to rely on yourself or something like that. So I do think mm-hmm. that gets in the way, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the interesting facts that I found during my research to prepare for this conversation, I was looking and I saw a website that mentioned that in 1910, during the census, in the census, that there were more black entrepreneurs than whites in 1910.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
right, and
right.
certainly
right.
You're right. Segregation, in some ways, forced that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the co-ops I studied, it was very similar to what I call marginalization, right?
Mm-hmm.
And lack of opportunity, lack of access, discrimination. All those things really led blacks to cooperate and collect, you know, collect their resources and then use them together.
Yeah.
And so you can see. I mean, we still have problems now, but you can see certainly like in the some of the most prolific co-ops in the black community I found were in the 30s, and early 40s.
Right.
So right around the Depression and coming out of the Depression. So often when people felt like they had no other opportunity.
Right.
You know, in the early mutual aid societies, which are also collective economics, those are definitely around deprivation, right? You can't get any other services. No one else will take care of your children if you die. No one will help bury you. And so they would do it themselves, right? Everybody put in their pennies.
Yeah.
And then if one member died, you had enough money to pay for their burial.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had enough money left over to help the widow and the children.
Right.
And so that's really where I also say it all kind of started with that kind of notion.
Mm-hmm.
And then often you could even start, you know, an actual insurance company might come out of one of those mutual aid societies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you already have someone who's handling the money. You already have the notion of paying your monthly premiums. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So at some point you can actually formalize it into an official company.
Right. And
mutual insurance companies are actually cooperatives. They're considered collectively owned businesses.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I don't think many people know that. You know
right.
what I mean? But that's what Because I believe one of my insurance policies, I think it's called Mutual Benefit Something.
Is a mutual,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and that should mean that you get some extra kind of dividend back if the company is profitable. I don't know exactly how they do it, yeah.
Yeah, so
credit unions also. Some people are members of credit unions because of their own union or they work for a hospital or a state or something, but credit
mm-hmm.
unions are financial cooperatives. And so they also are financial institutions owned by their members in a cooperative way.
Right.
And if you participate, which you're supposed to in a credit union, you actually vote on the board of directors and that kind of thing and can have input into the policies.
You know, that's also very interesting because I am, you know, a member of the credit union. I do work for the city of New York. And
mm-hmm.
But I don't remember reading that in any of the correspondence that I get a vote. I think I have to revisit my paperwork.
Yeah, you have to see. Now, my credit union does send me a ballot every year. So I don't know why yours doesn't.
Yeah, I have to check into that.
You'll have to see.
I'm learning a lot. So
yeah.
I really hope that people are paying attention. This is vital, vital, vital information. And that's what, you know, most people don't appreciate. I should make such a blanket statement. Some people don't appreciate or understand the importance of knowing history,
right.
But it's so, I just can't, you know, stress it enough how important it is to know and understand history and understand what happened, what worked, what didn't work, so that you don't repeat the same mistakes or build on it, you know?
Right.
And so speaking of building, how would you say, so now that we have, you know, some history about cooperative programs and that, you know, black people, that this is what we did, you know, initially post-slavery. How do these cooperatives benefit communities? How do communities benefit from cooperative corporate, you know, wealth? And how does that help the community? So if we say this is what we should be doing today, how do we benefit?
Right. And that's actually an issue I've been working on empirically. I'm trying to figure out how we actually can measure and give some real numbers
mm-hmm.
to this notion of community wealth and community wealth from a co-op. But I've also, and that's harder, and so I'll tell you I haven't actually solved that problem of how we can measure it in real numbers. But what I've been able to do is I've been able to do a lot of qualitative analysis, meaning looking at the spillover effects
mm-hmm.
and what impact they have on quality of life and how people relate to each other and that kind of thing. And so I don't know. I'm assuming your audience knows what a co-op is and how it works, but maybe I guess I could
try to explain it
simply.
Yep.
Yeah, because that will also help to explain how it connects to community. Cooperatives, so they're collectively owned companies that operate by democratic governance, which means that everybody who's an owner is considered a member, And it doesn't matter how many shares you own. In fact, many co-ops don't even go by shares. But if you're thinking about a share corporation where, you know, if I own 10 shares and you own one, I have 10 votes and you have one vote. So the fact that I put more money in the business gives me more say. That's how most corporations work.
Mm-hmm.
For a co-op, it doesn't matter how much money you put into the company. Everybody has one vote on all the major decisions. Now, if you put more money into the co-op, you'll get more back in dividends. You'll get more back, you know, so it's not like they're telling you put in $10,000, but you'll only get a dollar back.
Right, right.
So you still get your economic return in proportion to how much economic money you put in. But in terms of the governance, who has a say, whose voice gets heard, who decides on the policies, everybody has an equal voice. In very small co-ops, that means everybody's actually the board of directors and it's all the same. In the larger co-ops, you vote for the board of directors, like I said, with a credit union. But everybody has an equal voice, an equal vote. Everybody's vote counts the same. And so that's one of the really important things for a co-op, because not only does it mean you can pool resources in case you don't have enough, like housing co-ops. If one person doesn't have enough money to either buy a housing unit or to even get a mortgage, right? If you come together and form a co-op, you form the business gets the mortgage, each person puts in almost as if you were renting, right?
Mm-hmm.
An amount like that, but you're actually the owner along with your other members. You own your unit. Everybody owns the co-op business together. So
right.
It gives you that collective push.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, in addition to being able to get you financially able to either own an asset or have an asset, it also then gives you all these other pieces. You actually need to know more about the business because you have to be part of the governance of it.
Right.
It's not just like owning a stock and letting other people make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So because you have to be part of the governance, part of the decision making, you then start to learn. You need to learn things. You need to learn how the business operates. You need to learn
mm-hmm.
how to read a bank statement. You need to understand the budgeting. You need to understand how the company runs. If it's housing, you need to understand housing. If it's a furniture making or quilt making, you need to understand how quilts are made. And so you start to learn things. You also
mm-hmm.
learn, because you're in a democratic institution, you learn how to operate democratically with other people, how to come to consensus, how to talk
right.
through issues, how to vote where everybody gets a voice, how to make sure everybody's concerns are heard and talked about. So you
mm-hmm.
get all these other benefits, which then are going to spill over into whatever you do the rest of the other parts of your life, right?
That's right.
You may treat people in the community differently. You may take on leadership roles in other aspects of the community. You might join the PTA at your student's school or feel more comfortable speaking up or talking to the principal of your children's school. You might become involved in some other organizations. You might start another business now that you know how these things go. So there's
yes.
all those kinds of tangential, what I call these spillovers. There's also, and this is the part where I can't figure out exactly how to measure it yet, but it's also what I'm calling sort of locational capital, right? The fact that you're already part of a thriving business, collective business, where everybody collectively decides what to do with the surplus, how to run the company.
I think that means we have a caller, but it sounds like someone's ringing the doorbell.
Right.
Sissy,
okay, can I have say one more sentence before we take the call, or do we have to stop?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So I just wanted to say the other piece is if you're part of a collective business in a community that's thriving, it's also going to be a kind of anchor, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got one thriving business, you might want to buy your supplies from another local business. You might want to collaborate with another group to get, I don't know, to buy land or to do something else. And so the fact that you have this one collective business is also going to be a spur for other kinds of economic and business activity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I keep talking about it's not just that there's wealth within the collective business, But there's also some kind of community wealth because that business exists there, because of all the things you're doing, learning, because of all the things that business is already doing. It's going to help other businesses to thrive. It's going to create other businesses. It's going to create other kinds of capital and talent. And so, and those things will multiply around it.
Okay. Okay. I want to actually come back to the business anchoring component of that after we take the call. Sister Yvette, who do we have on the line?
Yes, we do have a caller on the line. Caller 0387, go ahead and make your comment or ask your question, please.
Good evening, Sister LaShawn. It's Michelle McPherson.
Hey, Michelle, how are you?
I wanted to congratulate you for coming back on to Black Hole Radio Network.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
We're glad to have you back. And I didn't get the sister's name who is your guest this evening. I came in sort of late.
Oh, this is Professor Jessica Gordon-Nimhart. Dr. Nimhart.
Hi.
Jessica Gordon-Nimhart. Hi, how are you, Jessica? My name is Michelle McCare. I'm actually a professor of media studies at the New School.
Oh, great.
Which is a place. Yes, it was a place where W.E.B. Du Bois was one of our instructors for many, many years.
Oh, yes, right.
Yes, and, you know, some of the theories that you're speaking about, the economic theories, were part of the basis for the founding of as an alternative, more progressive education system.
Right.
And, yes, and so it was a lot of his teachings that that the New School is based on. But I wanted to alert you to a couple of things. I have a film series called Creatively Speaking, and we are, our next series is this month, April 19th to the 21st, and one of the films that we're showing is a film called The End of Poverty. I don't know if you're familiar with this film. Do you happen to be familiar with it?
I'm not sure. Tell me more about it. It sounds interesting. I'm trying to remember if I know it or not.
It's a documentary by Felice Diaz, and it's actually The End of Poverty with a question mark. And the subtitle to it is Yes, There Is an End in Sight. And this film is actually offers some amazing insights into how we could end world poverty if we put our minds to it. And it offers concrete solutions, which, of course, we very rarely are able to find. But I would love to have your input on the film. In fact, I'm looking for someone to have a conversation with me at the end of the screening on April the 19th. And from the way I hear you speaking, you would be a perfect person. So I am sort of inviting you to co-host a conversation with me following the screening of this film. Of course, I could get you a copy of the film in advance, et cetera. But I think you would find it very much in keeping with some of the theories that you're speaking of.
It sounds very interesting. I'm actually not sure if I'm available on the 19th, but I would love to talk to you more about it. So,
okay, great. Well, John knows how to reach me.
I'll send you her. Make sure the two of you connect.
That would be great.
Immediately. Yes, definitely.
Great.
Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your sharing your knowledge. It's really, it is very important for people to understand and. Thank you, LaShawn, for having Jessica on.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, definitely. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sissy, but before we move forward, do we have any other callers in queue? Okay, I guess we can continue. The business anchoring component that you were speaking one of the spillover examples that you gave. One of the communities that I'm really interested in working with as a sort of a pilot for Black Reconstruction is Brownsville in Brooklyn, which is where I was born and raised, and it's just very near and dear to my heart. And there's a commercial strip of called Pickin Avenue, where there's like a ton of businesses, mostly retail, that pretty much the community that's made up of over 90,000 people, where they shop, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But there are also buildings that are somewhat empty, you know, dilapidated or what have you, that could be reconstructed, that could be invested in by the community, you know, that, and
right.
to create more businesses. So I'm really interested in the business anchoring that you mentioned, because I can see that, you know, and actually done cooperatively,
right.
you know, by community residents. You know, for instance, there's a building on the corner of, it's an old bank, ironically,
mm-hmm.
on the corner of Pickin
mm-hmm.
Avenue and Mother Gaston, that's up for sale. And it's been sitting there for pretty much about 7 years at
wow.
this point, empty, you know. And that's something that if a group of community residents came together to pool their resources and then, you know, attract additional capital, could do wonders. And that
right.
and those resources would stay within that community, you know.
Right.
So,
now,
so that,
yeah.
Uh-huh. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, so business anchoring isn't actually special to cooperatives. You
oh,
can use
okay.
the term, yeah, you can use the term business anchoring. In fact, the government does it. Like when they situate a government building in a
mm-hmm.
certain neighborhood, they also call that anchoring, because they figure if the government has put in money and puts employees there, right, then they'll eat lunch around the corner, they'll
mm-hmm.
park somewhere, and so, right? Developers also use that notion. Even some colleagues of mine are looking at existing anchoring institutions like a hospital, a university, and how
mm-hmm.
can you build services and businesses around that. So it's not that the business anchoring itself is special to cooperatives, but what's special or more unique is the kind of anchoring. So in this case, as we said, you're pooling existing community resources and community people who aren't going to pick up one day and leave if they find a better rent somewhere in another neighborhood, people who aren't going to sell out to somebody because they suddenly got a better price, right?
Right, right.
So in our case, the cooperative ownership makes sure that there's a much more local flavor and a local commitment.
Mm-hmm.
People who want to stay, who want to be in that neighborhood, who live there themselves, so they're also going to be more concerned about ecology and sustainability because it's their own backyard, it's their own neighborhood,
right?
Right. So it's a kind of business anchoring, but with this extra kick kind of thing.
Right.
Now, in your example for Brownsville, I actually have sort of a special strategy that I think can work in those kind of situations, and it involves a variety of different kinds of collective ownership. The first
mm-hmm.
thing I would actually do, and I don't know how feasible it is in Brownsville, but I would actually look to doing a community land trust.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you create a community nonprofit run by community members that actually would own the land,
mm-hmm.
or they could own the building if there's already a building on it. But the
uh-huh.
thing that's nice about a community land trust is the community then, the community board, the community organization owns the development rights.
Uh-huh.
So if you build a housing unit on top of it, the housing unit can remain affordable because the land is owned by a non-speculative community organization that's not expecting to get a profit, not looking to, you know, to get the property values up all the time. That
yes.
kind of thing. And so
okay.
it really can stabilize. There's an example that we use. The Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston
mm-hmm.
has used that strategy. They actually
okay.
took over a bunch of abandoned properties. They got the city to give them eminent domain over abandoned properties and then owned it as a community land trust. Then the community land trust worked with the community to figure out what kinds of buildings, businesses, housing units that were needed in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a whole community process to say, okay, if we need housing, then which properties, what kind of housing, and they could even build co-op housing on top of the land trust. Or if it's a commercial building, you could even rent it out if you wanted to an individual business, but then they don't own the land, they only own the building, or they're technically renting. from the
That's
land
right.
trust. And so if you're not happy with what kind of business they're doing or whatever, then they're gone. Or if it's a co-op or a local business that you want to help, you could give them a reduced rent, right?
Right.
Because,
exactly.
again, it's a nonprofit community group that owns the land. So in some
yeah.
ways I like, especially for this inner city redevelopment stuff, I like us to start there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a good way to keep development under control, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And
see, and that's exactly what's not happening now because of the people who actually own these buildings and are charging these very high rents. That's
high
why
rents.
They, you know, yes. And the business
exactly.
Is
and they're
the
in
profit.
It for the profit, right? They
right.
want to make
that's
a profit.
Right.
And once they make their profit or once it looks like they can't make their profit, they're going to sell out and run.
That's
right?
Yep.
So what we want is we want people who want to live there. We want people who deserve to have development there that benefits them, not some outsider, right?
Absolutely. That's
and
right.
so we want, right, and we want to empower people. The other thing is once you empower people to be involved in these kind of community ownerships, they're actually getting, they're owning some kind of asset. They have some kind of equity ownership in the business. They have some kind of asset development. So it's not just a handout or whatever. They're actually owners themselves and working on what else should happen in the community and what would make the community stronger as well as their own activities strong.
That's right. That's right.
And then you can do, I also am very much in favor of worker-owned companies, worker co-ops.
Yes, and
so we can talk about that next, too.
Yeah, because there's actually, in one of your papers, I read about the company, the manufacturing company that has a sewing business. I
yeah.
love that example, so I actually wanted you to talk a little bit about that. But, Sister Jen, who do we have holding?
Yes, actually, the call is calling from 8391.
Hello?
Yes, my question is, that I wanted you to expound more on SUSUs and if those are actually cooperative economic situations, cooperative economic methods. Thank you. I'll hang up in a minute.
Oh, okay. Hold
okay.
on 1 second. I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. So can you, are you talking about the cooperative lending?
No, you know how they have SUSU groups and there are people who put their monies together and I don't know how much you
yeah.
have knowledge about these, but there are SUSU groups and they put their money together and every week or month, I'm not sure how often they do it, but they have a payout to one individual
yeah.
and
yeah. okay.
it's a rotating type of
yeah.
way of people, like it's kind of getting a loan to some degree, but the person uses the money for whatever purposes they have.
Right.
And like I say, it seems like a kind of a cooperative economic method,
mm-hmm.
but I
right.
wanted to know if you came across it at all in your research in cooperative economics in, you know, among Black people or among people of color at all.
Right. And I just wanted to make sure we're talking about the same thing, and I also figured the audience could it would help if you told them what you meant.
Yes,
and
I'm
yes,
sorry,
so,
I didn't get your name. I'm sorry, before you answer the question. What's your name, sister?
Oh, it's actually your engineer, Sister Yvette.
Oh,
probably, I'm
oh okay.
Voice, I'm calling from my daughter's phone.
Okay.
So yes and no. So it is a type of what Du Bois would have called economic cooperation. And so it is. It's a form of pooling, right? Everybody, in this case, like a lot of other co-ops, you need to trust in people, right? So the group trusts themselves because everybody puts in whatever it is, $100 a month, but only one person gets the money out each month, right? So if it's not your turn to get the money out, you need to trust that everybody's going to put in another $100 next month and the month after that until it's your turn so you'll get your money back. So it is a great way for people, again, to pool resources. If you don't have that much, but, you know, you can rely on your neighbor's money and you know that 1 month a year or whatever it is, you'll get the pool, and another month the next person will get the pool, that kind of thing. It's not an official cooperative because actually there's an international definition and set of values and principles that international cooperatives go by that are then reflected in tax laws in the U.S. so that, you know, you wouldn't, if they wanted to actually call it a cooperative, they'd have to incorporate under certain rules and then apply for tax status under the U.S. tax laws. But it is a kind of economic cooperation. And pretty much I agree with Du Bois. I'm not sure that I care as much whether it's an official co-op, even though my book has tried to focus on the official co-ops just to show that we've had them. I think the most important thing is this, the collective nature that we, you know, we pool our resources, collectively use what we have, reduce the risk, right? Because it's much less risky to do things with a group of people than it is to do it by yourself. You also don't need to know everything, right? Because different people can specialize. So almost for the same reasons why corporations, you know, are made up of lots of different people. Similar idea with a co-op, but as we said, the co-op idea is that it's all much more democratic. All the decisions are made democratically. And the purpose is not really for profit, though most co-ops, because they're businesses, have to be profitable, right? They have to have break even at least, because otherwise you can't really stay in business. But the first purpose of a co-op is really to serve its members. So a co-op, people come together to serve a need. They define a need, and then they develop a co-op or a collective business in order to meet that need. And that's their first main mission, right? Then aside from that, they can also have a mission to either make a profit or to at least make enough money to stay in business and to be profitable enough to meet their needs. But they don't have to have, they're not trying to just create a profit for these outside investors who will then take their money and run if they either don't get enough profit or once they make as much money as they want. The purpose of these co-ops is to actually help people to accomplish something economically. So in that sense, you could say these, what I would call collective revolving loan arrangements, are also a kind of collective activity, but they're not formalized. Now, there are some credit unions that will do some lending circles, and so they have in some ways tried to formalize some of that. And those lending circles will be a similar thing, but it will be through a credit union, which is sort of an accredited financial institution. But they'll put, you know, 5-10 women together who kind of meet monthly, put all their money into a loan, a collective loan fund, and talk about, or either help each other with their ideas of what they're going to do with the money or help each other make sure they pay back the loan. So there are some more formal examples of that. But I know a lot of people, I've even heard people who tell me their families do that. They all, the families, like every year put in a certain amount of money, and whoever kid needs to go to college or whatever gets the money that year. And they've sent, you know, all their children to college that way and things. So there are lots of those kind of arrangements. And again, we don't always talk about them, or people don't really always share them. In fact, sometimes people are embarrassed by them because they feel like it means they didn't have enough money to do it themselves or they're doing something very risky. And yet, in the scheme of things, more of us, I think, are involved in that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Then we give credit for.
And I think, and see, that's the other thing that I think is so important about your work and what you've uncovered, you know, because it's there, but you know, it just hasn't been brought to the forefront. To, you know, to give a voice or to give life to this practice and to say that yes, it's okay, and not only is it okay, it actually works and it's a good thing.
Right. It can work. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the biggest issue is this trust, and really for co-ops, trust is a huge issue anyway because you have to trust the people you're working with because you are sharing pretty much everything, right? And so sometimes I've also noticed that sometimes co-ops kind of grow out of other situations where you're already in a trustful situation with people. So often it's if you're already in church, sometimes it's a church choir who all goes in and does something. Sometimes it's members of a church group. Or, again, you build that trust through the study groups. So there's lots of times where people already have some kind of affinity, and that's what brings them together in the first place. And then they also have to keep developing that level of trust so they can continue to work together. And then sometimes it does break down. I mean, the other thing people keep asking me, well, aren't there, you know, you make this sound like so idyllic. And in some ways it is idyllic because it's wonderful for people to work together in non-exploitative situations, right? But it's also true that it doesn't always work, right? Some co-ops
right.
do fail. Sometimes people can't work together. But the other thing I've noticed from my research is that every time a co-op, quote-unquote, failed, some other opportunity developed or other skills were built so the people went on to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
So even when, you know, you had a failure, and sometimes people call the co-op a failure even after 10 or 15 years of it existing, right, which is hard for me to understand. If it lasted that long and then died or whatever, why is that a failure? But anyway, often they fail because they actually accomplished their initial goals, right?
Right.
And so there was no reason for it to exist anymore. Or sometimes they fail because they couldn't quite get the connection. Everybody didn't quite trust each other and couldn't quite connect, or they didn't quite know how to manage democratically. But then everybody is much smarter after the failure, right? They all know so much more because they learned so much from that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they never start another co-op again, they might get a better job than they would ever have gotten before. They might start some other business. They might do other things with their children or their family. They might, you know what I'm saying? So
yes, right.
all the, because that democratic participation, you can't help but learn and gain other skills and things in the process of doing a co-op. So in some ways, to me, it's actually the process. It's not even the end product that matters. It's that process of thinking about economics in a collective, non-hierarchical manner, in a way that you care about other people in your community, and that you learn as much of the aspects of the business and how to work with other people as possible. And that, to me, is a win-win, regardless of whether the exact activity that you were trying to make happen ends up happening.
Right.
And that's the other reason why I really love co-op so much, is because to me you can't really lose, because in the effort, there's so much that you gain in the effort.
I mean, you know, what's so beautiful about the whole idea as well is, you know, when you hear people discuss like why black poverty is so high or unemployment is so high, or why, you know, we can't seem to work together, the crab in the barrel syndrome, you know, there's a whole bunch of, you know, terms people
right.
use. And, you know, they say, you know, the problem is, you know, we just need to unite. We haven't been united. And so working cooperative, this is like an actual science to
right.
formulate unity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the science
yeah.
of unity. So it's like, it's kind of like you said, a win-win. So if you begin
right.
to practice the science of working cooperatively, then, you know, unity is just kind of like an automatic byproduct. Of it.
Right.
You know. So,
yeah,
you
and
know,
there's so much you can do with that unity, as I said, because between the pooling of the resources, the pooling of minds,
mm-hmm.
the development, the skills that are developed, the attitudes that are developed, there's just, you know, there's so many different ways it can go. And I think we were trying to get to worker co-ops. One of the reasons I like worker co-ops
yes.
is because that's where, yeah, the employees actually own the business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they not only do the work, but they actually are the owners. So then they can make all the rules, right? They can profit from the surplus. They can, you know, decide what to produce, how to produce it. They can make decisions about whether they can afford insurance or health care or benefits or what kind of benefits. Also, a lot of worker co-ops can weather downturns instead of actually laying off people or firing people in a downturn. Everybody
mm-hmm.
agrees to earn a little less money,
mm-hmm.
But still everybody stays employed. Or often a worker co-op, because they're also the owners, right, they may keep their wages down, but then because they can divide up the rest of the surplus at the end of the year when they're doing well, they get all the bonuses, which add to their wages. So actually a lot of the co-ops try to give living wages, because that's one of their purposes of becoming a co-op, is so they can give proper wages and dignified work. So it's also a great way to kind of connect trying to make sure you have decent, meaningful work in a community, but also make sure that people who are doing the work actually own the company and then can share the profits.
Yes. Yeah, and
we have some great examples.
Oh, yeah. The one that really stood out for me was the Dawson Cooperative in Dawson, Georgia, and which was formed in October of 1997. And, you know, it's in the, you know, if you can just kind of go into it briefly, but, you know, it, from what I'm reading, they were able to increase their sales by, like in 19, by the next year, they were almost at $5 million, and then they expected to increase it by another $2.5 million by the 1999. So it's, they were extremely successful. So if you can just, you know, talk a little bit about that particular co-op. If you would remember the
details. I don't
not
have
really.
The detail, but I think it's the one, well, a lot of worker co-ops start when a company is going to be sold and moved away. I think Dawson was one of those. It was actually one of the, a national corporation decided to sell the plant.
Yes.
And so the city helped them to buy it, helped the workers to buy it, particularly the black women workers.
Mm-hmm.
To buy the company, and so, and then they were also able to get a grant. I think they got a federal grant because they were in one of those a county that was adversely affected by changes in trade or something. There were
funds
for that.
Yes. Yes.
Right, from the NAFTA. Right, so that helped them to be able to buy the company from the previous owners, And then I think they had some community help also. So that was the first thing, that they were able to use some public resources as well as their own. You know, they had to buy in a share. You do have to put in some money, especially in a worker co-op. But often you can pay it in installments. And then the other piece that was interesting is you were saying how they were able to make a profit. When they started, the first year, they were actually, oh, gosh, I can't remember the term, doing piece work. So they were actually sort of subcontracting to a larger textile factory.
Oh, uh-huh.
And that wasn't working for them very well because they were dependent on the other factory to give them the work and to pay them a certain rate, whatever. And so when they switched over, so they realized that wasn't working, but it was a way to start. When they switched over to not subcontracting with another textile company but actually selling themselves directly, to who needed the work, they were then able to name their prices better and control their their production and their income and that kind of stuff better. Then the next innovation I think they did was they figured out a way to increase productivity by giving a certain kind of bonus. I'm sorry, I can't remember the details. But they worked out a per piece. Like if you did 20 aprons in a day, you got a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were able to make 25, you got like double the money.
Oh, okay.
So that I mean that's not exactly what it was, but it's that idea, right? So
yes,
the idea was you got extra pay for extra productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And this way, the women who wanted more money, we were able to put in more time and be a little more productive and get a higher wage. With the women who didn't need it or needed time to be home or do whatever other things, could still get a basic pay and do a basic amount of work.
Okay.
Right? So it was able to both cater to the needs, the variety of needs of the women, but also to figure out ways to incentivize without making it unequal, sort of, right? So everybody had access to the incentive. You could either, and you could also do like 1 week, you could be more productive and another week not, right?
Right.
So
right.
It was kind of up to you. It wasn't that, you know, pushing you on an assembly line and forcing everybody to work at a certain pace or to do certain things, that kind of thing. But they were able to increase their productivity that way, which also made them more marketable to the places that would hire them to do the work, right?
Mm-hmm,
so that's
mm-hmm.
the other reason I think their sales went up. And then meanwhile, they were training themselves in how to run their own company and that kind of thing. So they were all learning, you know, the learning curve for business ownership was also going up for them. So that's another group where when you talk to the women, they all talked about gaining more confidence and feeling more secure about themselves as people. And also they were saying the black women, they'd, as black women in the industry, they'd always gotten the least amount of work and the worst job conditions, and now here they were running their own company.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have those kind of discrepancies anymore. They were no longer somebody who got the worst work. That seems to also be a really important issue for black worker co-ops or black people in worker co-ops, is
mm-hmm.
this they're no longer discriminated against.
Right.
There's, I don't know how your audiences will feel about this, but I'll also say there's a worker co-op peep show in San Francisco called Lusty Ladies.
Uh-huh.
They're sexual dancers, but they, you know, it's a peep show, so they dance behind a glass wall.
Mm-hmm.
But when I spoke to the black women in that organization, they talked about how what a difference it made to work in a worker-owned company, because now they weren't discriminated for being black sex workers.
Wow.
And every other company they'd been at, they either had to be at the very back of the window, so they never got enough tips. They could never be in a single window because the owners always thought nobody would pay for a black woman to be out on her own. If you were a little bit heavy, you got immediately fired.
Mm.
And now suddenly their body type didn't matter as much. Their black skin didn't matter as much. They were treated as equally as every other member of the group. They were part of the decision making. That group also alternates who the manager is. So everybody, all the women, actually, at least all the women who want to, have a chance to be a member for 6 months out of the year. I mean, not a member, a manager.
Okay.
Also, because the management position is so stressful, that's the other reason why they rotate it. So no
mm-hmm.
one has to be in that stressful job for that long a time. They own the company with the bouncers and the janitors. So there's the sex, the peep show women, their bouncers, and the janitors all own the company together. So it's a really fascinating way to look at the change in work, right? Change in work rules and control over work and what that means. As I said, and especially for the black women who are still a minority in that group, but they felt
mm-hmm.
much more empowered in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so, you know, the Cooperative Home Care, which is the largest worker co-op in the United States, is Latina and African-American women
mm-hmm.
who are home care workers, you know, used to be considered unskilled home care work below the nurses.
Uh-huh.
That group basically was able to totally raise the whole quality of home care by making a worker co-op. So they provided extra kind of training so that their home care workers would be particularly nurturing and capable, so they could charge a little bit more, so they could make the industry, they could actually give living wages and some benefits to home care workers, as well as to give them full-time work. So if you're a member of the co-op, you get full-time work, you get sick leave, you get vacation time, you become banked because they make sure you have a bank account and then give you direct deposit. They
mm-hmm.
now offer you a retirement plan. They also have job ladder success, so you can first get trained as a home care worker, but if you want to, you can also get trained as a nurse. You can get trained as one of their trainers and work in their training department, and you can also move up into the management of the company itself.
Wow.
So they've totally, and they also lobbied along with other home care groups for New York State to allocate more Medicare money to home care so that they could also be able to raise the rates, so that when they charged their higher rates, actually everybody was paying those competitive rates.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, with the Affordable Health Care Act, you know, about to be implemented, that's going to change things a little bit as well, you know.
Right. So that's another chance to get into that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, even and with that, because I went to a seminar workshop presentation is really what it was, at Health First Insurance Company last week, and they were talking
mm-hmm.
about what the Affordable Health Care Act means and how pretty much everybody's going to have to, you know, will be mandated to purchase health insurance, but it's pretty much any man's game at this point.
Right.
And so there'll be various insurance companies offering different plans. And so they, you know, Health First is just one insurance company, but New York State is actually looking for vendors to educate the community. They're being called navigators, you know, on
what products. Oh, right, yeah.
Right, right.
That could be a great co-op business.
Exactly.
Also, you can do a co-op health, and you can do co-op health insurance and co-op clinic.
That's right. That's right. And that was the first thing I said, you know, this is a great time for somebody to get into the game and be a competitor. You know, because I didn't, and the reason why I thought about it, it was because I didn't like the prices that I thought. I thought it was, you know, because I said, well, how is it that someone who doesn't qualify for public insurance, if they're not working or underemployed, how is it that they're going to be able to afford this? I said, no. You know, this can't be. And I remember, and I came and I told my husband. So he's like looking at me like, really? You know, an insurance company?
Right.
Like,
but yeah, no, you could do it. A mutual insurance company or a co-op, right? And, you know, the problem, you know, I don't want to get into politics here too much, but I don't like the fact that we're forced to buy from these for-profit health insurance companies, right? I actually believe health insurance should be non-profit.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least cooperatively owned, right?
That's right. At least cooperatively owned. That
right.
I'm with you. I'm totally with you. And so, again, you know, just going back to Brownsville for a second, you know, I'm looking at it, I'm like, okay, so there's a hospital in the community that's actually in financial trouble, you know.
Oh,
and I said,
yeah.
You know, uh-huh. I mean, the ground is so, you know, it's fertile.
Yeah. Once you start looking through these eyes through these glasses, whatever you want to call it, through this lens.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my friends are already tired of me because everything to me is a co-op, you know, a co-op potential. So
well,
no
I'm
one wants to even hear me
wagon.
Anymore because I'm like, oh, that should be a co-op. That should be a co-op. Oh, we could make that a co-op. Or why don't you do a co-op there? So, because I really do believe, you know, it's hard work. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not that it's easy to do.
Right.
It's a lot of hard work, but as I said, I think it's worth it because I also think the process is worth it, right?
Absolutely. And the outcome.
And there's so much to gain from the process, right, and the outcome, that it's worth it, even if it takes a little more time or it's a little more trouble. Because in the end, I think you get, you know, double, triple bang for your money once you get it going.
That's
right. Because
there's
so much other things. There's so many things that spill over, so many other benefits.
Mm-hmm.
That of them we can't even name. I mean, I haven't even talked about some of the, you know, all the kinds of benefits you can get from this.
Well, that means you just have to come back, you know, and continue this conversation. Because, you know, I mean, this and what I, you know, what I'm hoping that the listeners are getting from this conversation is that, yes, that number one, that there is a tangible solution to ending, you know, a lot of the community issues. And the answers lie within us. And that not only are we able and capable to do it, but guess what? It has been done before. You know what I mean? We do have a blueprint to follow. And first, such as yourself to help guide that process.
Yes.
So it gives,
and
it,
a growing
it gives
movement.
Yes.
Yeah, a growing movement, too, that wants to help, especially the worker co-op movement is the fastest growing of all the co-op movements. And there's people there to help. We're developing more and more co-op developers. We're trying to figure out more and more financing. So it's really it's an exciting place to be because lots of minds, lots of different activities happening. And so, yeah, there's lots of help for people who want to be involved and want to do it or want to try.
That's right. And then also now, just to mention briefly, the National Economic Association, you know, the immediate past president, that association, is that something like looking at financing for these types of projects? Is that something that the association does?
Actually, no.
Okay.
The National Economic Association is a professional networking group for Black economists and people who are studying the economics of people of color.
Okay.
And so it's actually mostly what we do is we have an annual meeting where we have sessions about people's research and findings.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also trying to work with HBCUs to shore up the teaching of economics to people of color. And I think we're looking to doing a blog on our website, which would have more discussions about economic issues for people of color and have black economists talk about an issue and then open it up to people to ask, you know, ask an economist kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and then move on to another issue the next month. So we're looking at those. So we mostly do sort of education and sharing of information, networking.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we don't really do we don't do financing at all, and we don't connect people to invest. You know, we don't do investment type.
I see.
Stuff. We mostly are doing education about economic issues and about the kind of research that black economists engage in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you
but
know,
there are other groups that are doing co-op stuff. Co-op, like there's the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops that's also looking into trying to find financing. There's the Federation of Southern Co-ops, which is a mostly black rural co-op group, and they do have a revolving loan fund and do do technical assistance and things like that.
Okay.
So there are other groups out there that are looking into this, and maybe that's another topic we could talk about next time.
Yeah, actually the next time we have you on, if we can actually specifically talk about financing, because one of the things that a part of my research before I launched Black Reconstruction was where the black-owned banks. And, you know,
right.
so I found, like, a list of, like, I think they were, like, 25. And at this
mm-hmm.
point, it may not even be 25 anymore because a few
right.
of them have merged. And so
yep.
one that really stood out to me was One United Bank. And I think they're, like, they just merged with, like, four smaller banks. And they're based in, I believe their headquarters is in Boston. They also have branches in L.A., and in Miami, but they're an online bank as well, and they're doing really well. Yeah,
wow.
And Terry Williams is the president. She
mm-hmm.
actually wrote a children's finance book called I Got Bank.
Great.
Yeah, yeah, and so I've been trying to connect with her because one of the things let me just kind of plug something really quickly. I run a Facebook group called the Entrepreneurs
mm-hmm.
of New York.
Right.
Which is based on cooperative economics and working with a network of people that, you know, represent a variety of businesses and services to, you know, advocate and encourage the buying and selling, you know, from and
mm-hmm.
you know, with each other. And so I'm about to launch it off of Facebook. Right now I've been building it since 2010, and I actually founded it on purpose on the fourth day of Kwanzaa that represents cooperative economics.
Right.
And
oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the birthday. And so that was in December 29th, 2010. And so right now I have about 1,130-something members at this point all
wow.
over the United States, as well as some from other countries as well. And what I would love to do, like a radical move, is say, okay, we're working as a group. Right? Why don't we take all of our resources out of these commercial banks that do nothing
mm-hmm.
for us and invest it and put it into an institution like a One United Bank, that,
right.
so that
right.
we're supporting that institution, and therefore that institution can support the community initiatives or the business
right.
initiatives of the small
right.
black-owned businesses. So that's,
right.
you know, just in an ideal world. I would love
mm-hmm.
to see that
yeah.
happen.
Yeah, or we could create a credit union.
Or
credit union. But sometimes it's easier to work with an existing financial institution so that we can
yeah.
explore all those things, yeah.
Yeah, so that would be the next conversation that we have, and really soon. And I don't, you know, definitely do not want to wait until your book comes out next year. We have
not
to have
next
much
year,
of
yeah.
No.
All right,
no,
well,
I,
thank
I,
you.
I know you are extremely busy, and I just thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule and your traveling and teaching. It is the middle of the semester, so I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your this information with us and just giving us hope, you know, that there is a solution and a tangible one that can be achieved so that we
right.
can reconstruct and build our community wealth. Because, again, and when you look at all the market research, it shows that as a community – we have over $1 trillion in buying or spending. Really,
right.
it's really spending
right.
power because we're not
spending power,
investing
yeah.
in ourselves. You know, we're
right.
spending our
and
money.
If we did invest in ourselves, yeah, what we could accomplish if we did invest in ourselves, yeah.
And how. So before we hang up, I just want to ask our listeners if they have any questions for you, and also if you have a website or information that you would like to share as well before we close you know, please feel free to do that. But Sister Yvette, do we have any callers in queue?
Unfortunately, I don't have a website and I'm not on Facebook yet. So the only thing people can do is search my name and you will come up with some, as you did, with some of my articles and some other things. You
okay.
can also search me on John Jay. There's a, I have a bio. I am trying to do at least a web page around the book, but I'm not there yet. So maybe next time I talk to you, I will be able to at least tell you.
We need to develop a little co-op to help you do that.
Yeah, there you go.
Get it done. Well,
I'm a little bit
so
slow
much.
On that stuff.
Well, you're busy working and figuring out this important
yeah.
stuff. So, you
yeah.
know, that's
yeah.
why you need a co-op to do it for you. So,
right.
But, yes, I really appreciate it once again. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on the debut of Black Reconstruction on Black Hole Radio. We're really excited to be part of the network, and we just encourage you all to just stay tuned. We're here every Thursday from now on, 9 p.m., and if you have any questions or comments, concerns, you can send us an email at blackreconstruction@gmail.com. Again, blackreconstruction@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. So we are here. We've created this platform. We want to hear from you. We want to work with you to help reconstruct our communities. And with that said, have a wonderful evening. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Yep. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Nembhard.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Brothers and sisters, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, Student Minister Henry Muhammad, and the believers cordially invite you to visit Muhammad's Mosque number 7C in Brooklyn, located at 202B Pennsylvania Avenue between Pitkin and Glenmore Avenues. Meeting times are Sundays at 11 o'clock, doors open promptly at 10, and Wednesday evenings at 8 p.m. For more information, dial 718-342-1900. Once again, that's 718-342-1900 or www.MuhammadMosque7C.org.
Now, boss, I remember when radio used to be just like this. You turn on the radio and you actually get something for your money worth, even though it's free. You had to pay for no satellite radio back then. You had good, solid radio for your brain, something that make you think. I remember. Now, that's like black hole radio or Blog Talk Radio.